Welcome to
America's Cannabis Conversation,
where you can hear experts from all facets of the cannabis business as to what's happening in this exploding industry. Keep yourself informed. Join the conversation. Hello, and welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation Quick News. I'm your host, Dan Perkins. Providence, Rhode Island. The Rhode Island governor puts marijuana legalization plan in the budget days after lawmakers file a competing plan. The governor of Rhode Island on Thursday unveiled his budget proposal for the 2022 fiscal year, and it includes a plan to legalize marijuana in the state. The move comes 2 days after legislative leaders introduced their own bill to tax and regulate cannabis sales. While there are a number of differences, the lawmakers and administration officials signaled they intend to work together as they move through the process. Governor Dan McKee's proposal calls for 25 marijuana retailers to be licensed each year in the first 3 years of implementation. Those would be awarded on a lottery basis, but 5 would be specifically given to minority-owned businesses, a category that also includes firms run by women, and additional licenses would be issued for the future based on demand. Sales could begin in April of 2022. The plan calls for a strictly regulated legal market for adult-use marijuana that is anchored in principles of equity and public health and safety, an executive summary from the budget proposal says. Prohibiting the possession, cultivation, and sale of cannabis to adults has proven to be an ineffective policy for the state of Rhode Island. The text of the legislation itself states, quote, "In the absence of a legal, tightly regulated market, an illicit cannabis industry has thrived, undermining the public health, safety, and welfare of Rhode Islanders. Regional and national shifts in cannabis policy have increased access to legal cannabis and marijuana products for Rhode Islanders in other states, the sale of which benefits the residents of the providing state while providing no funds to the state of Rhode Island to address the public health, safety, welfare, externalities that come with increased access to cannabis, including marijuana. Cannabis sales would be taxed at 17%, which includes the state's 7% sales tax and a special excise tax of 10%. An administrative official said on Thursday that the wholesale tax would also be applied, and the estimated would amount to 3%. The governor also included a call to create a weight-based excise tax marijuana cultivation. Washington, D.C. Key congressional chairman plans to refile federal marijuana legalization bill this year. The chairman of the House Judiciary Committee confirmed on Thursday that he will be reintroducing a bill to legalize marijuana and promote social equity this year. Chairman Jared Nadler, Democrat of New York, made the announcement in his opening statement during the Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime, Terrorism, and Homeland Security hearing that broadly addressed federal drug policy. He said that this session, he will again file the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement, or the MORE Act. The bill passed the House in a historic vote last year, but did not advance in the GOP-controlled Senate. Nadler said that the legislation will remove marijuana from a Controlled Substance Act and to provide restorative justice for communities that have been disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. Advocates have broadly cheered the bill's passage, even if the vote proved more symbolic than practical, given Republican opposition. But now, with Democrats in control of both chambers of Congress and the White House, reform activists want to see certain changes before the cannabis legislation goes to the floor again. Specifically, they have taken issue with the provision that was added in the last minute before the House action required a federal permit to operate a cannabis enterprise, along with restrictions that could ban people with prior marijuana convictions from being eligible. Lawmakers have signaled that those components would be removed the next time the bill is introduced. The Senate hearings. Biden pick for top Justice Department role backpedals on decriminalization of drugs. Drug policy advocates were encouraged when President Joe Biden nominated a civil rights activist with a history of supporting policies like marijuana legalization and broad decriminalization of other substances to the top Justice Department role. But they were sorely disappointed this week when she backpedaled on the issue, saying she's not too proud to admit the policy shift when questioned by GOP senators at her confirmation hearing. Vida Gupta, who has worked in the Justice Department during the Obama administration in addition to serving top positions at the ACLU and NAACP and the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, was selected by Biden to serve as the Assistant Attorney General. The news was celebrated by advocates who felt that having someone who had that background and who has promoted progressive drug policy could translate it into reform. But when pressed on her stance on the drug decriminalization by three Republican members of the Senate Judiciary Committee on Tuesday, Gupta said she no longer supports the policy. She did say in response to other Democrat senators, however, that she still believes that racial disparities in marijuana enforcement are a national problem and there should be alternatives to incarceration for low-level drug offenders. And now for something new, some quick shots. Agricultural Secretary Tom Vilsack has signed off on the final U.S. Department of Agriculture hemp rules despite concerns stakeholders have raised about certain provisions amid a review conducted during the presidential transition. Government Accountability Office rejected a complaint by Representative Andy Harris of Maryland by ruling that Washington, D.C.'s officials can take a step to prepare to legalize marijuana sales while congressional ban remains on the books. Representative Bob Good of Virginia sent a letter urging Virginia Governor Ralph Northam to veto his own bill to legalize marijuana, calling it a gateway drug and saying it would undermine the rule of law and expose more children to drug use at young and impressionable ages. Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont said his marijuana legalization bill has about a 60-40 chance of passing this year. He also said it wouldn't be the end of the world to amend to let people grow their own cannabis. And finally, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, mounting list of scandals could give added momentum to marijuana legalization plan that's leading lawmakers are proposing as an alternative to the governor's own relatively restrictive measure. This has been your America's Cannabis Conversation Quick News. I'm Dan Perkins. Starting off today is Dr. Cass Ingram, who is a student of the history of cannabis and cannabis extract. He says it goes back tens of thousands of years, and it was used for medicinal purposes back then. Great interview. Now we have Jordan Tischler, our cannabis doctor on call, who will be talking about the pandemic and the effect on his practice and how he and his patients have coped with the pandemic. In our third spot, returning to the program, is Dr. Steven Schmitz, who is an MD, and he is the co-founder of Supplement Safety Solutions. He's going to talk about what he thinks is happening now with the viruses and the vaccinations. And what do we do about the fact that 130 nations out of 195 have no vaccinations? In our final slot is a new guest, Rachel K. Gillette, who is the partner in charge of the cannabis business operation for their law firm. With the continued expansion of the cannabis business, she feels that potential investors need to be aware of the challenges and uniqueness of the cannabis business. So let's join the conversation. Welcome back to the conversation. This is Dan Perkins, and we have a very unusual guest, Dr. Cass Ingram, whose specialty is cannabis. And I asked him before the show, I said, Doctor, what is the thing that you want to talk about more than anything else about cannabis? And he said something that I've not heard many people talk about, and that is he classifies cannabis as an herb. So, Doctor, welcome to the conversation. And
you betcha, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Talk to me why classifying it as an herb is important to you.
It is because 10,000 years ago, they found some stone, you know, drawings or whatever, and the primitives were raising cannabis for medicinal use as a medicinal herb. And whether it's the pot kind or the kind for, you know, industrial hemp rope, it has certain properties as a herbal medicine. It's one of those unusual things that grows pretty big. You know, it can grow 8 feet, 12 feet when you raise it in a farmland, but it's still herbal.
So it's unusual because I've been doing this show for a year and a half, and you're the first person that I've ever talked to on the show that looks at cannabis as being, and I use my words, not your words, and you can disagree or agree, an all-natural herb that has great medicinal purposes.
Well, you know, if you just look at the history, you have no choice. You've got the ancient Egyptians that used it in surgery and childbirth to reduce the pain. They weren't taking it to make the child addicted to marijuana or the woman. It was just as a drug. They used it for nervousness, agitation. And the ancient Greeks made a medicine from cannabis so that you couldn't feel the scalpel much when they cut people open. Then you have the Islamic Empire. They figured out how to make a drug from it. I don't know what they did, boiled it and saturated it. But that drug was so effective, and it was cannabis, that you couldn't feel anything for 1 week after a surgery. So they did it so that people wouldn't feel pain. You see, so it was used. not that many people were sitting around stoking and smoking back in 500 BC, right?
If you say so.
Yeah, and I mean, there was that Mongols were in the 1200s were really heavy into marijuana smoking. But you also have the issue, as we talk about in the cannabis cure, of the Indians, the Indo-Pakistani area. They really did a lot with cannabis for different diseases, so much so that the British, when they conquered that area, decided to make a drug from marijuana or from hemp. Because the Indians were getting health, just different health benefits, nervousness, anxiety, paralysis, seizures, and insomnia, pain, chronic pain. They were seeing some results, the British guys, the doctors. So they made a medicine out of it. It was in every doctor's black bag, cannabis indica, back in 1910 or 1890. What happened? It disappeared.
But, Doctor, you seem to be describing many of the problems that we as human health problems that we as human beings are suffering today that was being treated using cannabis to treat 500 years ago or thousands of years ago. And we're still have the same product, cannabis, dealing with a lot of the same issues, just millions and millions or billions of more people. So did it drop off the face of the earth as a treatment?
Well,
what happened?
There are two problems. One was that the cannabis that the Indians used, or the primitives, was raw. Believe it or not, that's interesting. Mostly, they would collect the resin, sometimes running naked or with leather suits in India, to run through the fleet fields, and the sticky stuff would stick, and then they would scrape it off with a knife and make a ball. They sell that ball in the market. Okay, fine. But then now you've got American technology or British technology. Oh, we've got to make a standardized drug. So they started screwing around making a prolonged ethanolic extract, and they kind of ruined it to such a degree that it didn't work very good in the doctor's black bag. But they still used it, and they still talked about it. They liked their morphine a little better. The problem was that somebody decided that hemp was competitive to the nylon industry, to the cotton industry, the paper industry, and somebody that had a little money decided to do some propaganda, and they belittled it so much that they created federal laws. Oh, my God, we lost it for... I never smoked pot in my life, man, but I like using this for its herbal properties, and we lost it for 100 years. Now it's coming back.
Well, we had a situation up until the time the country decided that it was going to prohibit the legal sale of alcohol, that alcohol and cannabis were legal in the United States. When prohibition
they
came
were.
In...
They were. I mean, again, in the 1930s, most of the use was as these drops, this cannabis indica that was in the doctor's bag. There wasn't that much smoking. You had this clinic in France called the Hashishians, and they smoked it to think that smoking would help their... They were authors. It was going to help their intellect. Then they decided it's addictive and it's a problem. It's going to ruin your brain. They quit it, the Club de Hashishians. But we didn't have a big problem here, and we could have controlled that problem and kept it on the market. But no rope hemp. No. Hemp was a threat. Henry Ford made a car from hemp. You know, and even to this day, car doors have hemp fiber. And it was a threat to the cotton and the nylon industries. So they got rid of it.
Yeah. So when they passed prohibition, they made both alcohol and cannabis illegal. But when they repealed prohibition, they repealed the alcohol portion, but they left the controls on cannabis.
And yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good point, because you cannot compare the damage that alcoholism does to our civilization to hemp. You just look at the violence in a home. Look at the violence at a bar, violence on the street, and how commonly people are inebriated and they can't think straight on an airplane. It's not that they would have been violent, but for the alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
So even just and the damage with cirrhosis of the liver, with brain damage, with cardiac attacks. You know what the number one is cause of stroke is? It's alcohol. Alcohol consumption.
Wow.
In a person particularly under 70 years old. So a lot of damage. If you wanted to prohibit something, you'd take a look at that probably. Smoking.
And so what we wound up with a drug in the positive sense that had been tested for centuries of providing relief, made illegal, criminalized it, and now probably what, 75 years later, we're slowly working to decriminalize it.
Slowly, after we see 150,000 a year dying from opiates, I had a guy, he was on OxyContin. I gave him hemp extract, something called Hempanol Super Strength. Regardless, I gave it to him. I said, take 4 capsules 3 times a day. You're on the OxyContin. The guy ditched the drug. He was an arborist who was in a tree, and he was trying to prune a tree at 50 feet. I don't think that's too good of an idea. He fell out of the tree. But he's still free of the drug. It was that good. You see, hemp is also an anti-addictive. You can use it in the form we have now, CBD and then the full spectrum types.
Mm-hmm.
You can use it for addiction, even marijuana addiction. It's good. Alcoholism, heroin.
We have about a minute left in this segment, but I have a foundation that my wife and I started called Songs and Stories for Soldiers, and we deal with soldiers suffering from traumatic brain injury, PTSD, sleep deprivation, and suicide prevention. And in the PTSD, we found that cannabis and CBD both can aid in getting the soldier to REM level sleep, where the healing can
take
place.
Isn't that the truth? Isn't that? I'll tell you why when we come back. It has to help them,
right?
Whether they smoke it or whether I prefer the oral extract, but.
Okay. So, doctor, tell our audience how they can follow what you're doing and how they can reach you to find out more about who you are.
I have a kind of a non-commercial website called kazingram.com. You can get the books there, but kazingram.com. And there's some articles on hemp there. And so go ahead to kazingram.com and see what you can find. And podcasts are there, too.
And that's C-A-S-S Ingram?
Yep.
Kazingram.com. Well, thank you for joining us today, and it's always a pleasure, and we look forward to having you on again real soon.
It's time for you to make a decision about your health care. It's time for you to make a decision on how you're going to protect yourself against viruses. Isn't it time to make sure you have the strongest immune system you possibly can? Isn't it time to make a decision to buy CV Sciences CV Acute and CV Defense to help you build the strongest antiviral immune system you can? It's time for you to go to empoweryourself.info and purchase CV Acute and CV Defense and take charge of your health care.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on W420RadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back to the conversation, and joining us today is one of our favorite guests, Dr. Jordan Tischler. He's our cannabis doctor on call, and we haven't had him on the show in a couple of months. There's a lot of things going on in his life, especially with the restrictions. Dr. Jordan, welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to have you.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be back.
Thank you. We want to talk so our audience can understand how the pandemic has affected your practice. We talked some time ago how you have gone strictly to telemedicine, but there are some issues that are coming to the forefront as we perhaps look like we might be coming close to some resolution to what's going on in terms of the pandemic. So tell us about how you are concerned about how your business could change perhaps in the near future.
Yeah, well, you know, as you and I were chatting about a moment ago, having gone to the telemedicine has turned out to be an incredibly positive thing. As I think we talked about in a previous episode, I was not at all convinced that telemedicine was going to be a good thing, that while we had the offices and were doing mostly in person, I really felt that that was super important. And I had been doing some telemedicine kind of on the side, you know, with patients who had particular problems. And I thought, you know, it's okay, but it's not great. And then along came the pandemic, and that really forced us to shift to 100% telemedicine. And, you know, obviously that was an adjustment for me. It was an adjustment for my patients. But I think on balance, it's been a very positive thing. We've been able to see more patients over a wider geography. It avoids their having to drive in and in some cases find parking. Certainly many of my patients are physically hampered so that they're, you know, driving in and finding that parking, and just the whole schlep of it is particularly difficult for them. My practice partner pointed out to me this morning that many of our patients are immunocompromised. So again, not bringing them out into public is a good thing, you know, unrelated to COVID, but just sort of in general. So I think that those things are very positive. I definitely miss sort of being in the same space with my people. But I think that the pros actually outweigh the cons. And I think I mentioned in a previous episode that even, you know, one of the unexpected nice things with telemedicine is that you really get to see people in their homes where they live, and you get to see kind of, you know, more about their lives and more about them in their sort of, I hate to say, natural habitat. And I had this one example that was particularly notable where I was talking to a young woman who unfortunately had breast cancer, and she was sitting at her kitchen island while we were conversing. And as we were talking, her 5-year-old son crawled up on her lap and said, "Mommy, I need hugs." And I think that was priceless, you know, and I wouldn't get that if she had to come to the office.
Right, no.
So on balance, I think it's a good thing.
But there are, you now have some concerns about how that may come into jeopardy based on the laws in Massachusetts and some other states. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, you know, most of the states have enacted their laws with an eye to the ways in which the cannabis medicine practice is a little bit different from sort of other areas of medical practice. And in particular, because of this idea of a recommendation or a card or something like that, we've seen the evolution of large group medical practices that don't really actually practice medicine. They just dole out cards and collect a fee. And you know, we call those card mills. And it's very unfortunate because they're not taking care of their patients. They're just sort of taking their money and giving the card and then leaving these poor patients to fend for themselves. And usually that means talking to a bud tender who will make plenty of recommendations, but usually not based on medicine or science. You know, so I can understand why states like Massachusetts have had a wary eye on the way this has, you know, could be practiced. But in reality, one of the ways the states have addressed this is by requiring that that every patient have at least an annual in-person physical exam. And so that's what's written into the Massachusetts law, and it's written into a bunch of other states' laws. There are some other states that have a different way of approaching the same problem, which is kind of actually worse, but I can, again, understand sort of where they're coming from. Right now in Massachusetts, we're doing telehealth because under the state of emergency, the commission waived that aspect of the law, but it's pegged to that state of emergency. So when the governor decides to rescind it, then the question is, what happens next? And there are various groups that are sort of out there lobbying to maintain this telemedicine practice. And I, you know, have a letter written to the commission that I'm just waiting to send once I've gotten to know the new commissioners that we have a little bit better. But that's the concern here. And I think that, you know, it would be a shame for us to lose all of the benefits of telemedicine over these concerns, although I actually do admit that those concerns are real. You know, the flip side is that before the pandemic, when that requirement was in force, it doesn't seem to have stopped the card mills in the least. So clearly the intention of the law and the actuality are not really that connected. And it seems to me that what needs to really happen is that we retain telemedicine and we find some other guardrail, to use the terms that the lawmakers use, to you know, keep control over these people who are not practicing medicine and who are just sort of essentially behaving, well, I would say nefariously.
Yeah. We have here in Florida, I live in Southwest Florida, and one of the biggest practices in Florida here is Millennium Physicians, and I think there's 250 doctors in the network.
Wow.
And they're doing regular good old television advertising and promoting telemedicine as a better way for treatment. And they're very convinced. They still have their local offices and the local practitioner, and you can go see them, but they're encouraging people to adopt the telemedicine model. So in your case, where you got a special exemption, the regular general practitioner doesn't have any of those restrictions, I guess.
That's true. If you're just practicing primary care or something like that, then there's no requirements whatsoever with regard to sort of the type of office or lack thereof. You know, in the thing in general medicine is that there are certain kinds of medicine that are really amenable to telemedicine. A sort of basic, you know, check in with your doctor. You know, there are certain things you can't really do at home at the moment. Like, you know, they can't take your height and weight. They can't take your blood pressure, those sorts of things. But there are also ways around that. Like you could go in to an office or some maybe even like a CVS or something, you know, the week before to have those things measured, and then those would be reported back to the doctors, and then you see them by telemedicine. You know, psychiatry or any kind of mental health service, doing that by telemedicine is brilliant because it's just that much easier, and we do those kinds of visits, you know, fairly frequently. Some people see their mental health providers several times a week. So again, eliminating having to drive in and park and all that sort of thing is great. And, you know, with mental health, there isn't a laying on of hands in the same way.
Right.
On the other hand, it's really hard to do surgery by telemedicine. You know, I mean, there are just some forms of medical practice that, you know, are physical, and, you know, you can't be an orthopedist and examine somebody's knee or their spine without putting your hands on their body. And so we're going to have that kind of hybrid model that it sounds like Millennium has ironed out. And that's good. I think it's a great thing.
Right. Absolutely. We got about 2.5 minutes left. I wanted to ask you, if you look at this telemedicine, have you had any of your patients object to it?
No. I have had two things happen. One is I've had patients not be able to cope with it. That is to say, I've had a number of folks who tend to be on the older side, simply not be able to figure out Zoom. We use another telemedicine platform in that case because it's web-based rather than an application-based, and some of them can't even figure that out. And in those cases, I end up using a good old telephone call, and that's a little weird because you can't read body language, you can't read facial expression. You know, so it just becomes that much more divorced from sort of that kind of communication. But in a small minority of cases where this comes up, it is, you know, what we can do. And so we do it. That's been one case. And then the other thing is that I've heard reports from my staff that a few patients have, now that we're kind of hopefully seeing the light at the end of this pandemic, a few people have said things like, oh, you gave up the offices? That's too bad. I really was looking forward to seeing you back in person. And, you know, I can't argue with that. I think that that's great, and I would love to. I mean, many of my patients are people who I would love to sit around and have a cup of coffee with. And so I kind of do miss the physical office in that way. So thinking forward, you know, it may turn out that we get an office and that we figure out who needs to come in and who doesn't need to come in. We see patients multiple times a year, but maybe we would see them physically once a year and then multiple other times virtually. You know, I think that a lot of that is to be worked out, you know, in the future.
Well, unfortunately, Doctor, we're out of time. Tell people how they can follow you and get in touch with you.
Great. My name again is Dr. Jordan Tischler. My practice is called Inhale MD, and you can find us on the web at inhalemd.com. I welcome you to come to the website. There are whole bunches of blog articles that lay out a lot of good information for patients or potential patients about cannabis and what it can treat. And you can reach me through the website anytime you want, and that comes directly to us. So, again, inhalemd.com.
Jordan, thank you for joining us today.
Hello, this is Dan Perkins from America's Cannabis Conversation, and I'm here to talk to you about CV Sciences, the company that developed the immune system support products called CV Acute and CV Defense. One of the questions I asked the company was, how safe and effective are these products? Recently, I interviewed Stuart Tonk on my show, and here is his response to my question.
Science supports it. CV Acute and CV Defense are backed by research, cited by the World Health Organization for immune system challenges. It's safely used in hospitals. That's right, CV Acute is safely used in hospitals in Europe and in China.
If you want a productive immune system, you need to purchase both CV Defense and CV Acute. You can find out more information about both of these products at empoweryourself.info. Empower yourself and take charge of your response to COVID-19. You have the power to control yours and your family's health care.
Welcome back to the conversation, and joining me for a follow-up visit is Steve Schmitz, Dr. Steve Schmitz, who's been on our show several times. And I invited him back to talk about what he's expecting to see happen when we talked in our last show about 130 nations at the moment have no vaccine, have not put a shot in the arm. And what can we expect in the next 6 months or 8 months to the end of the year? And are there likely to be any surprises of strains that might test the vaccines we have? And if so, what can we do? So that's a big, huge softball there for you, Steve.
Dan, those are some profound questions that you're asking, but I'm happy to take a stab at them.
Okay.
So what do I expect in the next 6 months? You know, I expect that we are going to continue to experience a lot of people getting the vaccine. And so in our country, I think we're going to see a faster than originally expected herd immunity. And that's the great news for us. But when you mention the 130 countries that don't have any vaccines, that gives, as you're suggesting, that gives the opportunity to develop these mutations that may or may not be covered by vaccines. Mm-hmm. And I think we still don't know. We can speculate that they'll be covered because a lot of them are related to the spike protein, but we honestly don't know. Some of them probably will not be covered by the current vaccines. And while the vaccine companies can fast-track the development of something that would, you'd have to really have a dominant mutation to make it worth the while to do that. And so mm-hmm. I think what we're going to see, and I think you are, I just want to applaud you for bringing, focusing on COVID for your listeners, because this is the preeminent disease right now. It's not mm-hmm. cancer, it's not heart disease, it's COVID. So I really applaud you doing that and trying to give your listeners resources as to what to do. But you read about this more than me, Dan, but you've probably read that some people are suggesting this is going to be, COVID is going to be endemic, right? Not a pandemic, it's going to be endemic, meaning it's just with us for the foreseeable future. Now, if you're all vaccinated, then that's great, but it's going to be around. It's just not going to disappear at the summer, and it's not going to disappear when people get vaccinated. The vaccination is one really strong treatment to prevent them from getting the symptoms, but the virus is going to be around.
Well, the issue that you brought up, which I would like to focus a little bit of time on, is the concern about what's going to happen, which I think is what I wanted to talk about today, and you're doing that.
Sure.
But let me just say on that subject matter about what's going to happen.
Okay.
One of the things we don't know about this vaccine is how long it's going to be good for. And so we won't know how long until we get there. And when we get there, we may be looking at hundreds of millions of people that may have to be vaccinated again, Steve.
Absolutely. Go ahead. Excuse me.
And you've got 130 nations that haven't got the first one. If we develop a second one because the mutation has been so strong outside the United States unchecked, it could be much more deadly than what we had in the United States with the original COVID-19. I'm concerned that we don't find ourselves being complacent about our healthcare because we've got a shot. I mean, look at what happened in a matter of 1 week's time. 1 week ago, Dr. Fauci told us that even though grandma has had both shots, she could still get the virus in her nasal passages. I'm saying, wait a minute. Then 1 week later, the CDC comes out yesterday, Monday, and says it's okay for grandma and grandpa, if they've had both of their shots, to go visit their grandchild who has had no shots, and they can take their masks off. So, I mean, listen to this, the same organization in a week's time, and then they're saying, but our numbers have plateaued to 60,000 new cases a day. They haven't really gone down. So the confusion that's out there for the American people is just mind-boggling that our public health people have flip-flopped so many different times. I don't see a lot of confidence. I mean, you said that there more and more people are getting the vaccine, and that's probably true, but maybe less are comfortable about getting it because they have no idea that the medical professionals have any idea what the hell is going to happen to them.
Right, right. You know, I think that this underscores, Dan, that there's a lot that's not known about this virus. This is the biggest public health crisis in the last 100 years. And mm-hmm. despite a huge amount of science that's being directed to that, and in the scientific literature world, virtually all the articles are free. So they're posting them so that other professionals can see their work as quickly as possible. But despite that, there's still not great agreement. You know, I think that what's clear is that you want to be vaccinated. You still want to socially distance. You still want to wear a mask. I expect, it's just me, my opinion, I expect I'm going to be wearing a mask for another year. Now, I got the Pfizer vaccine, so based on statistics, I should be 95% immune. But you made the phenomenally good point that we don't know how long that's going to last.
Right.
I'm anticipating that we're going to need a booster, but we don't know when that's going to be. You know, that was a problem. That's both the curse and the blessing of the rapid development of this vaccine, is we really didn't look at how long immunity lasts, and are there certain populations? I think you suggested the elderly may be at higher risk, and that's probably because as we get older, our immune system is not as strong as when we're younger. So I think there's a lot that's not known, but I think, you know, we're going to just continue to vaccinate people. And I think to your earlier question about the 130 countries, that is a real problem. That is a real problem because mutations will develop when the infections are happening. If you don't have very many, if you have herd immunity, then what that means is not many infections are happening. So the likelihood of a mutation is down. In a country where there's no vaccine, the likelihood of a mutation goes up.
When we first talked several months ago, we talked about the frustration of the American person about what to do and the idea that that they had no clue. They didn't know whether they were going to get the vaccine or not. Some people were telling them they should, other people were telling them they shouldn't. And so the exhaustion of this whole year-long episode and continuing left people confused, uncertain what to do. Is there anything that they can do that they can take care of themselves, empower themselves, if you would, while this thing is sorting out?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I think as we've talked in previous sessions, your immune system is kind of at the base of what happens when you are exposed to a virus, whether it's the flu or the COVID virus, any bacteria. Your immune system is what responds to that. And so what we've talked about, and I know you're a big fan of, is taking supplements that boost your immune system. And so I'm aware of the company CV Sciences based in San Diego that has recently launched a couple of very interesting products. One is for the treatment of a viral conditions. It's called CV Acute. That's something you take at the onset of a fever, sore throat, scratchy throat, cough. And then there's another called CB Defense, which its name says it. It's really defense against bacterial infections, defense against viral infections. And it has both of these products have ingredients that have been tested in clinical trials that have been shown to enhance the immune system.
I have a true story to tell you about what you just said. A good friend of mine got viral pneumonia, and I called one of my doctor friends, one of your friends, and I said, he's been diagnosed with viral pneumonia, and the doctors are saying, well, there just isn't anything we can give him. And I said, could we encourage him to go buy the CV Acute, since it works for both viral and bacterial infections? And the first thing the doctor said, well, first of all, I know it's all natural, so it's not going to hurt him. And so I called him and told him where to go buy it at empoweryourself.info. He bought it, took the first day's dose, he called his doctor and told him about what was going on with his symptoms. He said, that's unbelievable. And he took a second day's dose, and he was so much better, felt so much better, that he didn't even bother to take the third day's worth of dose. So, you know, and I said to him, I said, I don't know whether this is going to work or not, but it's something that you do, because the doctor says you just have to let it run its course. And I've heard that happen. I had viral pneumonia, and I had a terrible bedridden case for weeks. It gave him something to deal with this virus that was attacking him with pneumonia. And I think that's important that you know, we can get sick from more just than coronavirus. We can get sick from pneumonia and other different things. And having an antiviral product like what you mentioned could be beneficial to have in your medicine cabinet.
Absolutely. And that's a great story. And it's not a lone story. And this is what we call an N of one or an anecdotal story, but it's a powerful one. And this CV Acute, the ingredients in there have been used extensively over the last 50 years. It's got three authentic, well-researched herbs that have been part of Chinese herbal medicine and traditional Chinese medicine for decades. And so it's actually been studied in populations, and it's been shown to decrease viral infections, bronchitis, and pneumonia. And it's got antiviral, antibacterial, anti-inflammatory, and anti-fever qualities.
Wow, amazing. Well, unfortunately, Dr. Steve, we're out of time. So tell people how they can get in touch with you.
Sure. You could get in touch with me at Dr. Schmitz at SupplementSafetySolutions.com. And if you want to buy some CV Acute or CV Defense, just go to www.cvsciences.com.
And if you want to learn more about the product, you can also go to empoweryourself.info. So thanks for joining us today, and we'll have you on again soon.
Dan, thanks for having me on. I greatly appreciate it. Stay well.
Hello and welcome. This is the next installment of What's in the Bottle, sponsored by CV Sciences. We think it's important for you to know what's in the bottle, and so this week we're going to talk about zinc. Zinc is needed for proper growth and maintenance of the human body. It is found in several systems and biological reactions. It is needed for immune function, wound healing, blood clotting, thyroid function, and much more. Meats, seafood, dairy products, nuts, beans, and whole grains offer relatively high levels of zinc. Zinc deficiency is not uncommon worldwide, but it is rare in U.S. Symptoms include slow growth, low insulin levels, loss of appetite, irritability, hair loss, rough and dry skin, and many, many more. Zinc might also have effects against viruses. It appears to lessen the symptoms of the rhinovirus common cold, but researchers yet can't explain why it works. If you want to help support your immune system to fight off viruses, then zinc is one of the important elements you need, and that's why it's in CV Defense. To learn more about a strong immune system, go to empoweryourself.info. This is Dan Perkins.
Welcome back to the conversation, and joining us today is an interesting person, Rachel K. Gillette. She is the chair of the cannabis law practice of Greenspoon Martyr LLP out of Denver, Colorado. Welcome to the conversation, Rachel.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted Rachel on because I read an interview that she had on another periodical, and she's talking about why cannabis people need lawyers. And when we talked before she decided she would come on the show, we were talking about with all that's going on in all the states in terms of expanding both medical and recreational, what's going on in Congress. I think there's going to be a lot of people who are going to want to get into this business, but they don't really know why they need a lawyer who's a specialist in cannabis. And that's why I invited Rachel on to come and talk to us about her practice, but also some of the challenges of becoming a startup in the cannabis space. There's your first question. What are some of the challenges in startup in the cannabis space?
Well, cannabis is actually quite unique. And it's not like any other business industry because we face these incredible challenges that it happens to be federally illegal, but also legal under certain state laws. And then you have states that have very different regulatory environments. And so it's really difficult to navigate through the licensing process at both the state and the local level. And you do need somebody that has some level of expertise in that. And just, you know, normal sort of everyday lawyerly contracts, et cetera, are going to be a little bit challenging for the everyday practitioner in cannabis because cannabis has this regulatory overlay in everything that a lawyer is going to be doing on behalf of a startup company. And so just your transactional documents are going to have a regulatory component to it. You have to understand the environment that the businesses are operating in. You have to understand the timing of licensing, for example, and how long it's going to take to approve a license at both the state and the local level, whether you even can apply for a license in a particular jurisdiction. All of those things are some of the challenges that these startups or entrepreneurs are going to face when they're looking to get into this space. The same thing happens in the hemp space too, by the way, because there's also some unique challenges for hemp products, particularly consumable goods, consumable products, meaning products you can eat. And so there's challenges at the federal level there. We have very new laws at the federal level. We have new regulations that are being drafted and implemented at the federal level. And then you have a patchwork of state laws. It's the same in hemp as it is in cannabis, and that presents a lot of challenges for your average startup company.
So if we look back a little bit in time, and we saw, I believe it was 2018 when the Farm Bill basically decriminalized hemp. Is that about the right time frame?
Yeah, well, there was sort of the start in 2014, and then there was 2018, which actually completely removed hemp from the list of controlled substances.
What happens if we decriminalize this cannabis at a federal level and take it off the book as a controlled substance, and now we have all of these states that have all of these differing regulations? What kind of a challenge is that going to create for people that who will now have the opportunity to possibly sell product on an interstate basis, an intrastate basis, that they can't do today? What kind of challenges are going to happen there?
Well, these are the questions that are being debated right now with our legislators at the federal level. The question is, what should the federal regulatory framework look like? You have a number of states. You have well over 30 states, probably over 40, I want to say, that have some sort of medical marijuana program that they've established and implemented. You have a number of states, I think the last, I mean, I lose count all the time because there's always states that are coming, are passing adult use cannabis, but I think it's around 15 or 16 plus the District of Columbia, adult mm-hmm. use states. And they all have spent a lot of time and energy trying to develop sort of the regulatory environment that works for that particular state. And then you have the federal government coming in and saying, okay, it's not just a matter of decriminalization. In fact, it might be easier if it was, where the federal government just said, okay, states, go do what you have to do. We're just going to get out of the way, and we're just going to remove marijuana from the list of controlled substances. That would be like a very easy answer, but look, we're talking about the federal government here. That's not going to happen. There is going to be some kind of federal regulatory framework, and the question is, how does that fit into state frameworks that have already been established? And we don't want to reinvent the wheel, right? Colorado now has regulated cannabis for coming on close to 11 years. It was July of 2010 that marijuana businesses had to start submitting their applications, and there was a state regulatory regime put in place. And, you know, there's a lot of work that's been put into that effort. And what we don't want to happen as an industry is for the federal government to create such a regulatory burden that states can't continue to operate and continue to go down the paths that they've already decided it works for them. And the states haven't gotten it perfect right out of the gate. I mean, this is something that evolves over time as
right.
to, you know, what works and what doesn't work. And I think there's still states that are sort of in this experimental stage and are trying to figure out what is the best path forward based on the states that have come before them. But I think you have to balance these interests, right, at the federal level. We want to think about public safety. We want to think about social equity. We want to think about righting the wrongs of, you know, the failed policies of the drug war. We want to think of taxation. We want to balance all of these things. And, you know, what does it look like? And those are the conversations that we have to continue to have as both an industry but also consumers. Continue to listen to all of the different stakeholders that maybe have a voice in this discussion.
Terrific, thank you. I think that one of the areas that has the greatest concern for me is that the industry is going to change dramatically in two ways if we decriminalize cannabis at the federal level. One, I think the players are going to change. I think the General Foods, the Procter & Gamble, Amazon, the big players are going to come in and want to be in this business. And the big challenge for the states, the biggest challenge, is how do you regulate the interstate commerce? Because right now you can't ship it across the state border anywhere legally. And so how do you have 50 district or 51 different jurisdictions talking about how they're going to handle interstate commerce? I think that's going to be a huge nightmare, especially as multinational corporations come in and want to stake claims in the significant business opportunity of cannabis on a deregulated basis.
I'm going to, bring it up one notch here and also just mention, what about international importation? That's another question that has to be dealt with too. If we decide to legalize cannabis at the federal level, is that going to allow for the importation of cannabis from other countries even? And these are, these are the types of conversations we have to think about. And, I think the interstate commerce question is a good one, and we need to be definitely thinking about that. The question is, should we allow? I personally don't think we should allow the importation of cannabis for, recreational purposes now. I don't know if things could change. I mean, it's just such an interesting concept that we're really starting. It's just sort of this starting anew. What does this look like? There's so many things that legislators have to think about, and I really think our approach from the federal level needs to be measured. I don't think we can do everything all at once. I think
right.
We have to take it step by step, the same way states have. What do we need now? What might want to change in the future? What do we need to think about going forward in year 5, year 10, et cetera? But we do need to be forward thinking as an industry, and as a country and as a state to think about what this looks like. And honestly, I think I kind of like the idea, and I've always loved this idea, and I think Colorado did this right, of thinking about local control, and that local communities can determine what's best for their communities. The same thing happens on a state level, with states, right? States determine what's best for their communities. And, my hope is that the federal government will allow states to continue the work that they have put into the legalization of cannabis and the regulation and taxation of cannabis. I don't think we have all the answers, but what I don't want to happen is for us to just, not take a measured approach when it comes to federal legalization, because there are so many things to think about.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. This flew by. And I thank you for joining us. We've been speaking to Rachel K. Gillette of the We've been speaking to Rachel K. Gillette of the Greenspoon Martyr Law Practice, and she's the chairman of the Cannabis Law Practice. Tell us, Rachel, how can people get in touch with you and follow what you're doing in the cannabis area?
Sure. They could go to gmlaw.com and search for my name and look up kind of what I do and what experience I have. I've been working in the cannabis industry for 11 years now exclusively, and I really love what I do, and I'm happy to talk with all sorts of entrepreneurs that are interested in this space.
And you can talk to people all over the country, not just in Colorado?
Yes, sure.
Wonderful. Good. That's good to know. Thank you for joining us today. It was a very interesting conversation. It really went by fast. And we'll have you on again soon.
Thank you.
Introducing CV Defense for daily immune support with PEA. PEA backed by 6 double-blind clinical trials. Reishi mushroom extract. A proprietary blend of immune-supporting ingredients non-GMO, gluten-free, vegan, exclusively from CV Sciences. Go to empoweryourself.info.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety, or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com. W420RadioNetwork.com.